No matter what happens to your phone this holiday, whether it crashes down the chimney or gets broken like a New Year's resolution, Verizon's got you. Now's your last chance to trade in any phone, any condition from one of our top brands and get a wonderful new iPhone 16 Pro with Apple Intelligence on Unlimited Ultimate and iPad and Apple Watch Series 10. That's up to $2,000 in value. So you'll save big on three amazing Apple gifts only at Verizon. Service plan required for iPad and Apple Watch. Up to $2,000 value based on iPhone, iPad, and Apple Watch. Trade in and additional terms apply. See Verizon.com for details. Apple Intelligence available now.
Indiana Jones and the Great Circle is available now. Uncover one of history's greatest mysteries in a first-person single-player adventure game set between the events of Raiders of the Lost Ark and The Last Crusade. The year is 1937. Sinister forces are scouring the globe for the secret to an ancient power connected to the Great Circle, and only one person can stop them. Indiana Jones. Adventure calls on Xbox Series X and S, Game Pass, and PC. Rated T for Teen. Copyright and trademark 2024 Lucasfilm Limited. All rights reserved.
Magnified with Matt Cooper. Proudly sponsored by Close Brothers Motor Finance. Recognized on Trustpilot as best in class in Ireland. With fast, fair finance decisions. Made in minutes, sometimes seconds. Motor dealerships and brokers. Looking to become a partner? Get in touch at closemotorfinance.ie.
Go loud. Sounds better with us.
Hello, welcome to this latest edition of Magnified with Matt Cooper, the interview series where we try to go in detail into our interviews with the guests. And the person we have with us today was recently a guest on The Last Word on Today FM, and we got a terrific response to his interview. Not all of it positive, but it was a very, very sizable response. But as it happens, I think there was a need for an even more detailed interview to go into in more detail some of the things that he brought up and go into other areas where we didn't have time to on the radio show. So that's what we're doing today, because he has a book, Running from Office, talking about his departure from politics, his career as a TD and as a minister, and why he gave it all up. Very much brought in a very honest way to this interview by Owen Murphy. So joining us for today's edition of Magnified, former Minister for Housing Owen Murphy, who has written an absolutely terrific book, Running from Office, Confessions of Ambition and Failure in Politics. Thank you very much for joining us. It is ruthlessly honest. You threw yourself entirely into this and sort of cathartic.
Thanks, Matt. Yeah, it was very cathartic writing it, but like difficult as well. But I knew that if it was going to be kind of worth anything that people might want to read, I had to be honest. And I had a great opportunity once I'd left politics to get a bit of space and time to kind of interrogate myself and ask myself, look, what went wrong? Because I had definite ideas about what I wanted to be as a politician, who I wanted to be and what I wanted to achieve. And it didn't work out like I thought it would. And so as I kind of interrogated that myself and began to think of writing and tried to start writing, I realized it was only going to work if I was going to actually put it all on the page and be as honest with people as I was being with myself. So that was kind of the approach that I wanted to take. But it's hard to do. I mean, it's cathartic, but it's hard as well, because I'd always shielded my private self as a politician. And here I've gone and done a complete about turn and given all of my private self, my inner thoughts, my thinking as I was navigating the ups and downs of a political life.
So, you know, thinking about this, I could sort of glibly say that you had a sort of a political breakdown, but actually that would be unfair and glib, because to all intents and purposes, you did have a mental breakdown, didn't you?
I guess, yeah. I mean, like the terminology is interesting, and I talk to my therapist about this stuff. You know, and at times I might describe it, you know, there's a bit in the book where I kind of have a breakdown in London and I kind of lose control of myself and I'm running through the city streets kind of panicking. And I used to often describe that as a panic attack. But the reason I don't go to kind of full breakdown, not that I know anything about this terminology properly, but was because I always retained some kind of sense of myself. I always was holding on when it got very bad for me. Some idea that I knew I wasn't thinking in the right way, that I knew I wasn't, you know, I knew I was kind of, a part of me was still there. I didn't completely lose it. And I was able to kind of fight.
You went on one serious bender over a couple of weeks.
That's right. I mean, that was the darkest period. And it's not like, you know, it's there in the book. But I was able to kind of rebound from that, thankfully. I didn't lose myself completely. And then kind of start to rebuild myself. And as I kind of call it in the book, recompose myself, get myself back into, hold on a second here. You have a very important job. People are depending on you. You don't want to let down people around you, and you don't want to let down yourself any more than you already have. So get it together and get back in the game. And, you know, the public mightn't have been aware that that was going on because I was very, very good at shielding this from everyone, from my family, from my colleagues, and from the public. And then again, like going back to the title of the book, running was one of the things that helped me, you know, that as a kind of a mental coping mechanism to kind of recompose myself and start to figure out where I was going wrong and prioritize what I needed to kind of focus on, you know.
You're not looking for sympathy, though, are you?
No, that's not what this is about at all.
And the reason I ask that is I'm sure, I mean, you're probably getting, I presume you stay away from social media because you're going to get the backlash.
Oh,
look at this guy. He was a failure. Now he's looking for sympathy or he's trying to make profit on the back of writing a book, blah, blah.
No. So when I first wrote it, I wrote it anonymously because I didn't want it to be about me. I wanted to tell the story of what it's really like in politics when you lift the curtain back, how it works, particularly in government, because people think government acts as one and it's one face. It is one face to the public, but inside it is perhaps more challenging than even dealing with the opposition. So I wanted to give that insight, but also to give an insight into how politicians think. Like, what's it really like when you're about to go into an interview and maybe your job is hanging on the line? And what's it like when maybe that interview doesn't go so well? How do you deal with that, or how shouldn't you deal with that? And I wanted to do it anonymously because I didn't want it to be about myself. But I realized that if...
That ain't going to work in Ireland.
Well, right. Yeah. Well, I think I know who this is, yeah. But if it's to have an impact, people need to know that it's real. You know, if the honesty is to have a point, if it's to have a force, if it's to be able to deliver the messages you want to deliver, people need to know, well, this is true. So, you know, it's not about sympathy at all. It's not about trying to rerun policy debates that I lost. I'm not trying to take a shot at anyone else, you know, other than myself, maybe. But, you know, and in doing that, I hope that people can kind of get a better insight into what's really going on in there, because you can't be fully honest with the people when you're in that role. You just can't. You can't be honest about the mistakes that you have made or are making. You can't be honest about how you feel about certain things. And that's challenging. That's tough.
We're going to bounce around the place because we have time, right? But one of the things that you also used to get kicked about a little bit about was that you were the sort of the posh boy who turned to politics. And what did you know about homelessness? And what did you know about people's struggles about putting a roof over their head?
Yeah. No, I mean, like the posh thing. So when I went into the politics at first, I banded together with a number of other young politicians who'd been elected, and we kind of formed this little group that Miriam Lord called the Five-A-Side. And we were these kind of rebellious backbenchers. And I was the only one from Dublin, and I was from Dublin 4. So it was a kind of joke amongst ourselves. I was this outlier in the group, and I was the posh.
Amongst all the culshies.
Yeah, basically. Yeah. And, you know, they would they'd talk about football and hurling, and I'd sit there with a blank expression on my face and, you know, I'd interject, start talking about rugby just for a bit of crack as we're, you know, kind of making it through the work day and the work week. And it was great fun. And it was kind of a source of amusement, that kind of banter, particularly myself and Brendan Griffin and Kerry, you know, and he'd talk about from Dublin 4 to Farran 4 and just the massive difference between the two of us. And he had an idea for a TV show called TD Swap. And I'd go and represent his constituency for a month and he'd go and represent mine. So like, that's how I kind of navigated that part of myself in the political world. But it wasn't until much later that people kind of tried to weaponize it against me. And I think to a degree, they were kind of successful in that. But one of the things I talk about in the book is, you know, if you're going to get upset about anything that people are criticizing you for, I mean, that's the last thing you need to get upset about, right?
Did you actually understand fully the issue of homelessness? And did you fully understand how difficult many people find it to pay the rent or pay the mortgage?
Well, I could never understand it. What a homeless person is going through. Absolutely not. But I tried to put myself into the front line as much as possible, going out with the they don't like to be called rough super teams or the soup teams, but the people going out every night to try and help people into accommodation. I'd go to some of the emergency accommodation places in the morning to serve breakfast. I would do these things to try and get a better understanding, not just of what people are experiencing, but also what the frontline staff are saying that they need to help improve these things. And you know, the role of the politician, I think, particularly one who's put into a position where they have executive power, is to try their best to understand what the best policy response is. But as an individual, no, I couldn't understand. I mean, it couldn't be a visceral thing for me because I hadn't been in that situation myself. I was very fortunate in my upbringing. I was very fortunate in the family I was born into. And I recognized all of that. And what I wanted to do was to, because it was how I was raised, was to try and make a difference. Use, you know, help people have the opportunities that I had that maybe they weren't getting to have. But I don't think for politicians, whether it's a politician going into education or it's going into housing or other things, that they, I mean, it can help if they have that experience.
Yeah, see, I'm wondering, you know, some people would seem to argue that it should almost be disqualifying in that you don't really understand what things are like for most people. I was highly amused to read recently the Irish Times review of your book, which they gave to Owen O'Brien of Fin Féin to do, who marked you. And he brought up this issue about you coming from this comfortable middle class and having the confidence of the private South Dublin school education, which you got in St. Michael's. Mm-hmm. And what school did Owen O'Brien go to?
I think he went to BlackRock.
Yeah, I know. And I was going like, what?
No, but like, I mean, to be fair to, I mean, like Owen makes that point and whatever about that. But I did have a confidence that comes from my background, you know. But I don't think we should reduce people to their backgrounds either. Like I spent 6 years in a fee-paying school, but I also spent 6 years in a national school. I went to UCD for free because the state pays for it here. But I had to pay for myself to go to King's College in London to study there. But I did have opportunities that others didn't have. And I tried to do something with them. Politics wasn't initially my intention. I mean, I loved international politics. That's where I saw myself going.
Yeah, that was another one of his criticisms of you in the review, in that you weren't really a committed politician to serve the people. You were a committed careerist.
No, I don't know if that's fair. I mean, I try to capture this in the book, right? Because there's points where your idea or your ambitions change. So when I first got involved in politics, I didn't know much about Irish politics at all, but things were happening at home that I wasn't happy with. I was living in Vienna at the time, and Obama was running in America, and I was kind of inspired by that. I was 25 or 26, so were my friends. We were starting to be more socially aware.
Yeah, nothing wrong with that.
Yeah.
You would hope that more people, as they go into adulthood, would want to get involved.
Yeah, and so I was working in these international fora, and I was thinking, like, I was giving all this time as a, you know, as I saw it as a kind of a small cog in a big machine. And I thought, well, what if I went back home? Maybe I could be more effective if I was able to become a big cog in a small machine. And so I went at it with a lot of optimism and confidence and idealism, not necessarily into the city council. And I'm honest about that in the book. I didn't know local politics, and it didn't seem terribly exciting talking about speed ramps and that kind of stuff.
Collecting the dog shite.
Yeah, you know, and that was like, you know, again, someone said, if only I could sort dog shite, I'd be elected in a landslide. I'm like, well, how exactly am I going to do that? And what does that campaign look like? You know, but yeah, so initially I was cynical. I was like, look, I'll try and join a party. And I picked Fine Gael, and they're not going to run me in a national election because they don't know me. So they're going to test me in a locals. Okay, I'll go along with that and I'll try and get elected there. And then I get elected into city council, and it's just this completely foreign world. I don't understand the language, the codes they use, the norms in a kind of a political chamber like that. But I do start to learn a lot, and I start to, my cynicism about local politics completely changes by the time I leave only a year and a half later. And when I go into the Dáil, I'm still idealistic, and then I become frustrated. But the idea of careerism only comes to me when Leo Varadkar is elected Taoiseach. So in my first term in the Dáil, I didn't care about advancement. I was just so happy to be there speaking in the national parliament. I didn't come from political family, so this was a fantastic opportunity that I had. And I really enjoyed being offside with Enda Kenny, who I really regard. But I liked the fact that we were challenging our own government and challenging what we thought was the status quo and looking to reform more and more quickly.
God, you're in West Winger, aren't you?
Well, completely. I mean, it's so embarrassing, but I completely, you know, like the whole box set a few times and, you know, walk and talk, let's go, you know, and all this kind of nonsense. And we had really high ideas about ourselves. But so, you know, through that first term, it was kind of fantastic, even though it was frustrating. But then there's a minority government being formed after the 2016 election. And Enda Kenny looks to me, because I was the kind of reformist, and we need to reform things to get a minority government in place and to bring people in into with Fine Gael. And I'm rewarded with a junior ministry under Michael Noonan, which is this incredible...
The Department of Finance.
Yeah, incredible apprenticeship. Because Michael Noonan, being around, old war horse, a titan in terms of Irish politics, Fine Gael politics, and was so generous in terms of showing me the ropes. Because one of the things I talk about in the book, no one shows you the ropes when you go into the Dáil, and you're not meant to ask any questions. you're kind of meant to learn by watching or by accident. I'm not quite sure, but it's got this kind of Byzantine kind of rule structure. But yeah, so Michael Noonan taught me a lot, and then Leo's starting to run his campaigns. But by the time it comes to him putting his government together, you know, I just want to be at the cabinet table. And so I talk about that kind of, it's actually at the start of the book.
Ambition emerges.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And
you want to be in the room where it happens.
Yeah, big time. Because, you know, there was this great moment where Leo gets elected after the leadership campaign. He gives his speech in the Mansion House. Myself, himself, a few of his advisors, maybe five of us tops, go into the living room in the Mansion House. And he takes a call from Theresa May. And I'm sitting there going, holy shit. Like, this is the very center of power in the country. And I'm in this room, and I want to stay in this room. And so something clicked with me then. And I kind of knew it at the time because I was maybe reacting more emotionally to the idea that I might not be included. And I went to confront Leo. And so that's where the careerist thing takes over. But then you get the brief, you get the housing brief, and you're like, right, now I'm going to show why I even got involved in the first place. And then that doesn't happen, but that's, you know, later on in the story.
Yeah. How close were you to Leo?
Yeah, like we became very close around the campaign. So that whole period. And we had, our lives had interacted, political lives had interacted since I had become a councillor. But we weren't, not in a kind of pally way, not kind of, that didn't develop until I was trying to bring the five-a-side over to support him should a leadership contest emerge. So probably around 2014, maybe. And, you know, I mean, a good period before he came out, because he came out to me privately before he came out kind of to the nation. And I think that was in 2015 when the referendum, and he came out in the January of it, maybe. But so by that point, he could trust me, or, he, you know, to be kind of that personal with me. And then we became, I thought, very close during his campaign. And then into that first period in government, you know, because I was very involved in not just things in my own brief, but wider. And so we would socialize, or we'd go to events, and, you know, you're at an event, lots of people want to talk to you, but you're like, oh, there's Leo. I'd rather just kind of hang out and have a chat with him and have a bit of crack if we can, depending on what the event was. So there was a period actually where we were kind of very close, but I think it was always overinterpreted, maybe perhaps by the media, that the people watching, that maybe they thought that we were in lockstep on everything ideologically, but also the best of mates all of the time.
Yeah, but how did you then feel when he started almost pushing you away?
Yeah, I mean, so it gets to a point where I've become quite toxic for the government, and I'm no longer kind of getting invited to the things I used to be invited to. I'm no longer involved in making some of the bigger decisions that I used to be involved in. And I start to get a sense of this. And, you know, that's why I talk about in the book, you know, it can become quite lonely then.
Did they lose confidence in your judgment, or was it that you were just regarded, well, the media is bashing him, the opposition's bashing him, we're having to fight votes of no confidence in him in the Dáil, that you became a liability in the public eye? Or was it that they actually also started questioning your political judgment?
I think it was both. Definitely, I was like a lightning rod for criticism. And when you put myself and Leo together, they could talk about these two, you know, privately educated, out of touch guys, you know, we're doing a triathlon, we're bumping fists in the water, and people are getting really pissed off at these idiots, you know. And I get that now. I didn't get it at the time. I thought this was good copy.
This, you know, wry self-deprecation runs throughout the book, I have to say, as well.
But you know what I mean? Like, but
and it's one of the strengths of the book.
Well, thanks. But at the time, I was like, this is cool. But no, it wasn't. It really, really wasn't. And so there was that. So it was like, I know, or I suspected at least, and I don't hold any kind of grudges or ill will, because I get it, because it's the government of Ireland and it needs to be performing well. So if there's an element of that government that is actually causing difficulties where there doesn't need to be any, let's push it over here for a while. And so I did feel that happening, but I also felt maybe Leo losing confidence in my judgment, and fair enough, because I was making mistakes, I think. So then it becomes that even privately, you're not included in what's going on. So it's one thing to not be invited to something that's a public event, but when you're not getting invited privately, you know, that's, you know, you really, your self-confidence starts to dip.
Yeah, this would be undermining your self-confidence even further.
So, and not to sound all kind of,
you're in
like
a spiral at this stage.
Yeah, and not to sound all like, woe is me, because look, you know, it's all relative, right? In the scheme of things, things were fine, but mentally I wasn't looking after myself. So this was after the first motion of no confidence, because there were two. But this was after the first motion of no confidence in September, which I survived. but it left a big mark on me in terms of my mental health. To fight back, to stay in that job at the time, almost overwhelmed me. And then things, I let them pile up in my mind, you know, impressions of maybe people, again, pushing me out or not trusting my judgment, you know, negative coverage in the media, I'm letting bite too hard, that it does overwhelm me. And I get to this point in the Christmas of 2018 where, yeah, I kind of lose it in London. I've gone over with a couple of colleagues for a bender, you know, because we just want a break from it all. I don't really want to go because I know I'm kind of like skirting the edge a bit. We go over. I don't have the courage to tell them how things are for me, even though they're good friends, because they're also politicians. And as I say in the book, you know, they could rise from my fall. So you know,
trust nobody.
But there's a bit of that, unfortunately, even though they're really good people and they probably wouldn't do that. You just need to be super careful, and you're also not in a great state of mind. So just that night in London then, and again, going back to the title, Running from Office, is when I literally run across London from like Bloomsbury to Hackney. And I'm just trying to find a way out. And of course, it doesn't make any sense. But I'm like, how do I get out of this job that I've become trapped in, where I don't think I'm doing any good, and everyone else agrees with that? You know, how did it go wrong? How do I fix this? What do I do next? And it was a moment of panic. You know,
I presume you have permission from the ex-girlfriend to put in the story, the bit about how you'd broken up and then discovered she was pregnant, then discovered that she lost the pregnancy, and you broke up again.
Yeah, so, I mean, again, in writing the book and how I hoped it might be different from other books, I'm not trying to write about other people too much or interpret what they might be thinking or feeling or even what they might have said, because I might not even remember what I said in the moment. So with everyone, whether it's someone like Leo Varadkar or someone like my ex, I've tried to be very careful. But obviously on that issue, you know, look, I'm trying to protect her privacy. That's the most important thing. And I did speak to her, you know, and we spoke about it before I published the book, because in a way, I didn't want to write about that bit, but I had to write about it because I was absolutely resigning as housing minister. I mean, that was happening. I had an exit committee in place. I had the timing. I had the strategy. All that was left was to tell Leo. And then I got a phone call asking to meet up. And I met up, and she was pregnant. And she was quite pregnant, actually, because she hadn't been aware that she was. So I talk about it in the book only because I would have quit then. But by the time, unfortunately, we went to the hospital and a few other things happened, weeks passed, and I realized that it was too close to the local elections. I'd missed my window to resign, and I had to stay on then and fight. And so that's why it's mentioned in the book. But I've tried to mention it sensitively, because it was a very difficult time for me, but it was far more difficult for her. And she's someone I care a lot about.
Hello and welcome to this latest episode of Magnified with Matt Cooper. And it's a little bit different today, because this was recorded in front of a live audience at the Blockchain Ireland conference, which took place at Trinity College recently. I got the opportunity to interview Anthony Scaramucci. You must know the name. Remember, he was infamous for spending just 11 days as the White House press spokesman before Donald Trump fired him. Fired him because of a whole batch of profanities in a recorded conversation with a journalist, which he thought was off the record, but he'd never actually said that. And even Trump couldn't take the opprobrium which followed as a result of this gaffe. He has, though, been a loyal servant of Donald Trump in the past, but has now turned against him entirely, and is the co-host of the exceptionally good podcast The Rest is Politics US with Kathy Kay. As well as being a terrific political commentator and insider, he also has a deep knowledge of the investment markets, and his company is very involved in investing in cryptocurrency. So part of this podcast today looks at financial markets and cryptocurrency, but perhaps explains it in a way that I haven't heard explained as well in the past. And he also goes into politics about Donald Trump, recorded just the day before Donald Trump was found guilty in a New York court and became a felon. So we don't go into whether Donald Trump should be jailed for that or the outcome of the trial, but he certainly has very strong views about the suitability of Donald Trump to return to the White House as president again. So here is your podcast. Here is Anthony Scaramucci.
Is there something, though, of an asset price bubble across all classes at present? We've seen the Dow Jones crash through 40,000 mark. The S&P 500 is up again after a bumper year last year. You've told us about what's happening in relation to cryptocurrencies. Is there a danger that after the cheapness of money that we had for a number of years, and that the asset prices have still continued to go up, even as interest rates have gone up, that there's a detachment from reality in relation to the real value of assets?
It's a very good question. I ask myself that question every day, because one of the things that has kept us in business for the last 20 years at SkyBridge is a constant relitigation of our portfolio. And so I look at our assets under management every morning and say, okay, is this the assets that I want on? Suppose I got fresh money today, would the configuration of our portfolio look the way it does? And I think you can only really see the bubble with hindsight. As an example, NVIDIA is trading over $1,000 per share today. I think the growth of that company is exciting, and there's probably a lot of hype in that story. Yet, if I sell my NVIDIA shares, which I happen to own right now, am I going to be right or wrong? There could be a short-term blip down 20, 30, even 50%. But I'm wondering if the long-term trends are in my favor, and that's an exceptional company. And I would just point out to people that the mistakes that I've made in my career have been selling things because of price appreciation. And so I'd like to tell you that I owned Amazon the whole way, but I didn't. But I'll just be brief on this. I bought Amazon on the IPO in 1997, May of 1997, so 27 years ago. And if you had held Amazon, let's say you put $10,000 into Amazon stock 27 years ago, it's worth about $16 million today. However, you would have had to gone through 20 periods of time where the stock lost at least 50% of its value. One period in March of 2020, where it dropped almost 90% in value. And so one would say, well, was it at a bubble then? And should I have sold it? And how do you time these things? And my response to this is always that if you own high quality things in the market and you're patient, I think you're long-term rewarded. If you're analyzing the market day to day and you're worried about the near term, I think it's the wrong investment to be in the market. It's the wrong investment to be in Bitcoin or stocks. But if you think like a Warren Buffett or you think like a long-term holder, even if we are in a bubble today, and I can't honestly tell you if we are or not until after the fact, rates likely are coming down. I know that this is something that people don't see. People were anticipating a 3 to possibly 4 rate cuts for the United States and our central bank this year. Now they're saying 1 to 2 rate cuts. But I think otherwise. I actually think there'll be at least 3 rate cuts this year. The data that we're looking at, and I would tell people to please go to truflation.com, truflation.com. This is a decentralized aggregator. This is away from the government data. We have a expression. It's a little bit of a cliche, but I think it's worth saying. There are lies, there are damn lies, and then there are statistics. And of course, the government can manipulate these statistics in lots of different ways to make the data, frankly, distorted from reality. But if you go to some place like truflation.com, you'll see that the inflation numbers are trending down, which means that the Fed is going to have to cut rates. And so if the Fed cuts rates, we are definitely not in a bubble, because everybody listening knows this, but it's worth repeating. Interest rates are the financial gravity of financial assets. Lower rates mean higher prices. So I wouldn't be too soon to sell this market here, assuming that it's a bubble. But I do hear what you're saying. Prices are high. I don't want to be like Irving Fisher, though, when in October, early October of 1929, Irving Fisher told people that stocks had reached a permanent high or a permanent plateau, was the exact quote. And of course, 4 months later, the market crashed down 90%. So I've been humbled by life. I've been humbled by markets. I'm not here being overconfident in my assumptions, but I do think that we're okay here given where the proclivity is on rates in the near term. i.e. over the next 12 to 18 months.
When you were with this conference last year, the trial of Sam Bankman-Fried was going on at that time. So now he's convicted, now he's in prison. What do you think of it all now? Has he received an appropriate sentence? And for a wider scale, is it something that the market has shrugged off, that he was like a rogue element who was not representative of what's really going on?
Well, yes. I mean, the answer to the second part of the question is yes. I think the market has shrugged it off. I think it's a more nuanced, and I'm probably more sensitive about this because I was close to Sam, and I think I said this last year at this event that I trusted Sam and I liked Sam, and so it was very sad for me and it was heartbreaking to see unfold what actually unfolded. And my recommendation to Sam was to come clean, tell the truth, negotiate with the prosecutors. He would have gotten a way lighter sentence. The three young people that pled guilty all got lighter sentences or fines, or in one case, no sentence. Sam was the kingpin, if you will. So he probably would have been penalized with a jail term, but I don't think he would have gotten 25 years. And so just to explain to people quickly, if you'd make a decision in the United States, you're under federal prosecution and they've asserted various crimes against you. If you make a decision not to plea out or to plead guilty to something and have a plea bargaining situation with the prosecutors, if they go to trial and you are successfully, prosecuted as guilty, then there's a sentencing grid that the prosecutors have to follow. And of course, they tell you all this before you begin that process. And so the bottom part of that sentencing grid was 25 years. The top part for what Sam did was 35. And so the judge gave him the more lenient side of that. But you're asking me if I think it's fair. Listen, people are mad at me for saying this, and he hurt me. He hurt my reputation. He hurt my business. I got a lot of negative press as a result of my relationship with Sam. But I feel bad about the situation, frankly. And I think that Sam, while misguided, everybody got their money back at the end of the day. And this was really a process issue for Sam. And if you mentioned Michael Lewis, if you read his book, the book that he wrote about Sam Bankman-Fried, the title of the book is Going Infinite. I think he makes a pretty clear case, and he spent 6 months of his life with Sam, very, very close. I think he makes a pretty clear case that there may have been some criminality, but it wasn't as broad-based as what was asserted. So I'd like to see his sentence commuted, frankly. I don't think he deserves 25 years. Having said that, I understand why he got 25, and he didn't listen to really good advice from a lot of criminal defense attorneys, which would have told him to plead out with the prosecution. But that case is behind us. I will say this, because I want to be balanced, and I know there's a lot of young people that you guys are sharing this information with. I don't like Gary Gensler. I don't like Elizabeth Warren. I think they, by and large, have hurt the United States in terms of the way they go about regulation. And I would suggest that we think about regulation in terms of what is right or wrong for the country, as opposed to what's hard left or hard right. I think we've overly politicized our regulatory process. But I will give Gary Gensler credit for this. He, regulatorily, if you look at our laws, when he approved the Bitcoin futures, there's a clause in administrative law in the United States that says that you cannot be the administrator, in this case, Gary Gensler, cannot be arbitrary and capricious in terms of the administration of the law. And so when he approved the Bitcoin futures ETF, I was asked on television, well, what do I think about the cash or the spot ETF? I said, well, that'll get approved in 3 months because that's the law. Gensler held back that approval. Now, you could say he broke the law. I'm not saying that, but he was sued, and the lawsuit contended that he acted in an arbitrary and capricious way, and of course, he lost the suit. But I will say this, the positive byproduct of Gary Gensler delaying that ETF was he opened up the seam in the marketplace to expose all this fraud. and all this over leverage. And so even though he didn't administer the law pursuant to the way the letter of the law was written, I do think that Gary Gensler helped the industry by cleaning out lots of fraud, lots of over leverage. And so we sit here today at a $68,000 number for Bitcoin. That's a sturdier, less levered number than the 69,000 in November of 2021. So there are always silver linings to this sort of stuff.
Over your shoulder in our shot, over your right shoulder, there's a poster of Superman. That's not one of those Superman posters that had Donald Trump in it, is it?
No, that's like the real Superman. No, I mean, could you imagine Donald Trump naked? I mean, I'm telling you, he does not look like Superman, this poor guy, you know?
Well, we know from Stormy Daniels a few things about that.
Unfortunately, he's after listening to Stormy discuss his anatomy, you know he's overcompensating all that hypermasculinity and the high heels in his shoes and the orange war paint. You know, there's a lot of compensation this poor guy's going through in his life. But you know, the truth be told, he's very close in the polls. And I think he's going to lose. But this election is way too close. It doesn't need to be this close. And it just speaks to what the hard left is doing in the country, that the middle roadsters in the country, sort of the people that are more moderate, don't like that culture that the hard left is imposing on the country. And this is one of the reasons why Trump is close in the polls.
I'll get to that in one moment, but you mentioned about the prison sentence that Sam Bankman-Fried got. Could Donald Trump avoid prison no matter what he did? He might be convicted in the next few days or weeks on the current trial, but even if he was to do what he once threatened, walk out into Fifth Avenue and shoot somebody, has he reached a stage where it is impossible to imprison Donald Trump no matter what he does?
Well, I think the more despicable thing about him is that he's broken all of the norms and all of what we thought were the fair gentlemanly or gentlewomanly protocols in our society. And so when our founders were envisioning who would end up in the presidency, I don't think they were thinking of rogues like this. And so he has stretched the norms. If you put Trump in jail, you set up the dominoes that really hurt the United States and create a banana-like republic where we're starting to jail our political adversaries. So even though he may have committed these crimes, I think it's very hard to put him in jail because you don't want one part of the country to believe that he's been put into jail for political purposes as opposed to legal and factual purposes. And so I just remind people historically in the United States that Richard Nixon resigned from the presidency August 8, 1974. By mid-September, his successor, President Gerald Ford, had pardoned him and basically said whatever crimes that he had committed, what the United States is going to forgive, and he offered him a presidential pardon. Now, there was an uproar at the time. Senator Ted Kennedy, Jack Kennedy's brother, fellow Irishman, who was in the Senate representing Massachusetts at that time, rebuked Gerald Ford. He said this was a disaster, travesty of justice, and Mr. Nixon needed to be jailed. In 2009, when Senator Kennedy was dying from brain cancer, he wrote his last memoir, and he spent a whole chapter on this, and he wrote in there that he had made a mistake in September of 1974. He said that he wanted Nixon to go to jail, but he realized over the ensuing 30 plus years that that would have been the wrong thing for the country, that ultimately Gerald Ford was wise to pardon Nixon because it put down the politics of the situation. And of course, he said something apocryphal in that chapter. He said, well, of course, you know, this will likely not happen again, but here we are with Donald Trump. I think it'd be a mistake to put him in jail. He may or may not be convicted in this trial that's going on here in New York. He's got two other cases, both of which are probably more damning for Mr. Trump. The documents case, where he stole classified documents and put them in his bathroom at Mar-a-Lago, why we know that some of our intelligence agents in the field have died since those documents were taken from the White House. And so, you know, you have people in the agency and various intelligence departments of the U.S. government that are very sore about this. And then the last case, which I think was two other cases, frankly, there's the election fraud case in Georgia. We'll have to see what happens there. But the other case is the insurrection case. They got him on tape, you know, Mark Meadows. You know, when Trump says, well, this is lawfare and this is a Soros-sponsored African-American prosecutor coming after him, it's just not true. In the insurrection case, Mark Meadows, the very white Christian conservative who ran the Freedom Caucus for the House of Representatives in our country, who was Mr. Trump's last chief of staff, is the chief witness for the prosecution. So they have him on tape explaining what he was trying to do. They have him on tape with reckless disregard for the vice president's life. I mean, there is a reason why Vice President Trump, who was on the ballot with Donald Trump in both 2016 and 2020, is not endorsing him. Moreover, you know, we've got a lot of political cowards in this country. This guy, Kevin McCarthy, who's a spineless jellyfish. I mean, hopefully you'll get a chance to interview this guy. I mean, he's exactly my age, but he looks 500 because he's lied for the last 10 years for Donald Trump. And, you know, now he looks like Grandpa Munster from the Munsters. But this guy could have put Trump lights out through the ropes on the 7th of January, had him impeached in the House, which he was, and then convicted in the Senate. They had the votes to do that, but they chickened out. And so now we're dealing with Trump again here in 2024. Now, I predict he'll lose this election. But since they won't put him in jail, we'll be dealing with an 82-year-old Donald Trump in 2028. We'll have to defeat him again. And while he's doing all this, he has decimated the center-right party, which, you know, are the Republicans. But I think that Republican Party is really almost on the way out, the way the Whig Party, frankly, was on the way out prior to the Lincoln election in 1860.
That level of analysis is why I've recommended The Rest is Politics US as a really entertaining and informative weekly listen. But something else that strikes me is that the economy seems to be going very well in the US at present. We've mentioned the stock market indices, the price of gold, various other things. Inflation is falling. Interest rates are going to come down. And there was a saying, I think going back to the Bill Clinton era, it's the economy, stupid. That's what dictated people's voting. So why is that not the case for Joe Biden? Why is he not able to sell his success in economics to win this election?
It's a really good question. And so I'll start out by answering it like this. Joe Biden no longer looks like your grandfather. He looks like your great grandfather. And so it's almost impossible for him to do what he needs to do, which is to get out there and sell that agenda. And he's been unsuccessful at doing that. Lots of gaffes. He's a lifelong stutterer. I think I mentioned this on The Rest is Politics. He broke his foot a while back. They put his foot in one of these big boots. They told him, you got to leave it on for 10 to 12 weeks. He didn't like the boot. He thought the boot was bad optics for him. So he took the boot off after 2 weeks. And that was a mistake. He can barely put any weight on his right foot. And so if you watch him doddering around, the foot break has made him look older than he actually is, or older than his physicality actually asserts. I mean, he's on the Peloton bike every morning working out. He's in way better shape mentally and physically than the press or Donald Trump want to give him credit for. And I think we'll see that on display during the debates. But he just cannot get out there to sell that economic agenda that you're talking about. Second part of the answer has to do with inflation. Unfortunately, in the United States, we inducted too much money into the system during COVID. We reduced interest rates to zero, and we sent trillions of dollars into the system. And I'll point out to people listening, when you do something like that, you're going to cause inflation. And so we like to personalize things on our politicians that are situational. So in the 1990s, during the Gulf War, we went into a recession. That was George Bush's recession. When the Gulf War ended and the economy started to boom, well, that was Bill Clinton's economic recovery. And so we blamed one politician and we favored the other, but it was really just cyclicality. Had Donald Trump won the election in 2020, this would be Donald Trump's inflation. But he didn't win the election. The inflation would have been there one way or the other. but it's being fingered and blamed on Joe Biden. And this is having a big impact on the polls. And I'll just point out to people, and this perhaps is another case for Bitcoin, the United States, the U.S. dollar has lost 25% of its purchasing power since January of 2020. So in a 4.5 year period of time, we've hit the dollar by 25%. If you're a middle income person in the U.S. or a lower income person, you are feeling that. You're feeling that price at the pump. You're feeling that in terms of your grocery bill, your utilities bills, and et cetera. And that could make you want to make a political change. So the Biden campaign would be well advised to get some younger people out there to advocate on behalf of the president, explain why this happened. It's really not his fault, but also explain some of the good things that he's done. And I'll just be brief. I'll name two. One is the CHIPS Act, where we've got all these microprocessor foundries are here back in the United States. And the second thing is the infrastructure bill, which in addition to rebuilding roads, bridges, and tunnels, we're also reshoring a lot of our manufacturing. All of this has happened in the last 3.5 years in the Biden administration. And despite Trump's rhetoric, it did not happen in the 4 years that he was president.
So why is it that so many people in big business are in favor of Trump over Biden, particularly when, and this is something else you said on The Rest Is Politics, Trump is effectively threatening to deport 15 million people if he returns to power, people who are very important in the workplace and without whom the American economy might not function properly?
Well, I mean, it's more than that. I mean, let's just say that what we'll call the 15 million, I guess he's going to go around and like Handmaid's Tale Brinks trucks, these armored vehicles, I guess, and swoop people out of their houses with machine guns and take them out of the country. I guess that's something that he wants to do, which is, to me, quintessentially un-American. The second thing he wants to do is he wants to double up the tariffs with China. Now, we're in a cold war with China. We're in a, you know, lukewarm or somewhat lukewarm economic competition with China. So even President Biden has anteed up some more tariffs on China. Well, it's a small part of the economy, but the rhetoric is there. But I mean, I could name 15 things that Mr. Trump wants to do that are un-American, that are anti-business. Particularly if you're a communications executive, he wants to take your FCC license. He's been very open about this. If you disagree with him, he wants to take your FCC license away from you. He's also said to two of his former defense lawyers, one of which is a personal friend of mine, that he wants to use the FBI as a Gestapo. Now, what that gentleman also said was the good news is he doesn't know anything about history, so he doesn't even know what the Gestapo means, but he wants to do this. But business leaders are for Trump because of the imagery that Trump represents. He is a business person in their minds. Prior to COVID, the economy more or less did okay under Trump. And, you know, business leaders, they don't like the left-leaning cultural issues that Mr. Biden is bringing with him. And they don't like all that stuff. And so that's why they're probably for Trump. But it's a mistake. And I've tried to point out to people, whether it's on The Rest Is Politics, my public remarks on television, or even my remarks here, that Mr. Trump is threatening the legal stability of the United States. Mr. Trump is suggesting that he'll corrupt our legal precedent, and at his whim, he'll do certain things like go after his adversaries using the FBI, persecute people. He's suggested openly that he wants dictatorial powers. There's something in the United States called expanded or unitary executive power. If you look up unitary executive power on Google, you'll see what the Heritage Foundation is saying about knocking out the other two articles of the Constitution and making the executive branch way more powerful. All of this stuff is very dangerous for the world. Yeah, I don't know why the business leaders think he's more positive, but I do think it's a cultural issue.
Quickly to finish, Anthony, because yes, I'm conscious we're at the end of our time. But
sorry.
I do want to ask you, you have said that you believe he will not win. Is that wishful thinking in your part, though? Because the polls in 5 of the 6 swing states say that he will win. So yep. All your worst nightmares could come to pass. So is it wishful thinking in your part when you say that Biden will win?
I don't think it's wishful thinking. I'm a fairly objective person. I understand why people think that Trump could win. If you look at those polls and you look at the Real Clear Politics averages, most of those polls have the president, meaning President Biden, inside the margin of error. It's sort of a 1 to 2% differential. Campaign really has not heated up yet. It's very, very early. And I pointed out on The Rest is Politics, and I'll share with you guys here, President Biden spent $35 million over the last 2 months building field offices in these swing states. And I'll submit to everybody here, these are two entities, these are two political figures that are known by the American people for the last 50 years. It's not like someone's waking up this morning saying, God, I got to see what they say in the debate before I make my decision. I mean, these are people that are well known. It's not the Barack Obama 2008 introductory tour, and a result of which this will be a get out the vote exercise. The Democrats are more organized. They have more of the registrations. I'll just point out to everybody listening, it's independents first at 41%. Democrats in the low 30s in terms of their registrations in the U.S., Republicans in the high 20s. And so this sort of stuff favors the Democrats when you get into a nail-biting election like this. And this is a get-out-the-vote exercise. They will outman the Trump campaign because they have more money than the Trump campaign. And a lot of these things do come down to money. But we'll have to see. There's gaffes that could happen. There are October surprises and things like that. And as I said earlier, I've been humbled by life and markets, and so I could be wrong. But I got it right in 2020. I said Mr. Trump would lose when the consensus was favoring him. I said he would win in 2016 when the consensus was not favoring him there. And the consensus right now narrowly favors him. But I think this will be the incumbent's race to lose. The economy will get stronger. Rates will get cut by the back half of this year. And this will be a big get out the vote exercise that the Democrats are really good at.
Anthony Scaramucci, there's loads more if we had time that I'd love to ask you, but it's been terrific having you for the last three quarters of an hour. Thank you very much for joining us from New York.
Thank you, guys. Buy some Bitcoin, Matt. Get off zero, Matt. Buy some Bitcoin.
And that's it for today's Magnified. Hope you enjoyed it. Lots of other interviews from this series that you can go back and listen to if you want. And if you'd liked it, you'd recommend it, please, to a friend, wherever it is you're listening to it, be it Apple, Spotify, or, of course, on the Go Loud app.
Magnified with Matt Cooper. Proudly sponsored by Close Brothers Motor Finance. Recognised on Trustpilot as best in class in Ireland. With fast, fair finance decisions. Made in minutes, sometimes seconds. Motor dealerships and brokers. Looking to become a partner? Get in touch at closemotorfinance.ie.
Go Loud. Sounds better with us.
No matter what happens to your phone this holiday, whether it crashes down the chimney or gets broken like a New Year's resolution, Verizon's got you. Now's your last chance to trade in any phone, any condition from one of our top brands and get a wonderful new iPhone 16 Pro with Apple Intelligence on Unlimited Ultimate and iPad and Apple Watch Series 10. That's up to $2,000 in value. So you'll save big on three amazing Apple gifts only at Verizon. Service plan required for iPad and Apple Watch. Up to $2,000 value based on iPhone, iPad, and Apple Watch. Trade in and additional terms apply. See Verizon.com for details. Apple Intelligence available now.